Good morning. We're here to talk about media relations, risks and benefits, potentially pitfalls as well. And we have a wonderful group to talk about that, all experts in the field. To my left, Linda Martin and Robin Cohn, Mara Antonoff, Robert Merritt, and John Conte. So we're going to jump right in because there's a lot to talk about. Linda, why don't we start with you? Can you relate what's been one of your most challenging media relations events, and how did you handle that?
Well, fortunately, I haven't had any really bad things happen so far, but I did have a live radio interview and we were talking all about pain management and reducing opioids. And the second that I disconnected from the call, the two commentators sat there and said, well, hey, when I have surgery, give me some pain pills. And it was very unfortunate because the call was over and I couldn't say anything back.
Got it. Robin, have you had any challenging moments?
You know, I don't think I've had a particularly difficult one. I think that one of the keys to that is understanding where the media is coming from and where you're standing, and to make sure you're on the same wavelength. And I think that gets particularly challenging in a situation where you have an investigative reporter who's on a mission. And sometimes something that you may say gets taken out of context, or you don't understand exactly the purpose of why you're there. So I think it's really important to clarify that so that there's a good understanding there.
Yeah, and I guess to add to that, I think if you know you're going to meet with an investigative reporter, assume they've talked to your enemies, and also make sure you do a Google search on whatever the topic is up to the minute, because what if something just happened the day before? You don't want to be caught unawares.
Robert, Linda sort of mentioned, and Robin sort of mentioned, dealing with a tough question. How do you handle that?
Well, I think you just sort of want to understand the perspective of the media representative, what they're trying to get at, especially if it's negative media coverage. You want the facts to be presented in a way that represents what actually happened. And just being honest, I think, is very important. And that's how you diffuse a lot of the negativity around the coverage.
John, how do you handle the tough questions?
Well, honestly and forthright, I think you have to do that. But one of the important things is to keep in perspective that we work in a very technical and scientifically complicated field. And we have to make sure that our answers and the conversation is conducted at a level that the average person who might hear this can really understand. We can't be talking about oncologic receptors. We just have to talk about lung cancer and different stages and things like that. So we have to be very, very careful that we can connect, not just with the reporter, but the people who are going to hear the topic that we speak on.
Mara, you're sort of a star on social media. I'm sure you encounter some challenging moments in social media as well, not just a straight interview. Do you have any stories that are relevant to that?
Absolutely. I can actually, two examples come to mind fairly readily of situations on social media where I have been involved in interactions with individuals of other specialties. This is a kind of a frequent argument between thoracic surgeons and radiation oncologists about the management of early stage lung cancer. And usually the conversation is pretty friendly banter, sharing data, but I've been involved in interactions where there has been research papers that are taken out of context or data that are used inappropriately. And it becomes really challenging because on one hand, your obligation is to present the truth to the public and you want patients to have accurate information, but you don't want to get involved in interactions that become unprofessional. And so it's really knowing when to draw the line. And usually I take a deep breath and just take a moment, think about it, and think of a way to present the data in a way that's beneficial to the patients without seeming combative to the public that might be watching it, regardless of how they're coming at you. And I would say I've also been in interactions on social media that representing the Women in Thoracic Surgery on social media, where unfortunately we've been targets sometimes of people on Twitter or Facebook that write really negative messages about the role of women in cardiothoracic surgery. Again, it's really challenging because we want to be able to reach the public as well as prospective trainees, but also the public whom we serve and our patients, so they understand how important diversity and inclusion are within our specialty. And we have to think carefully about how to frame our responses so that we don't seem combative and aren't creating an argument or coming off in a way that defrays from the respect of our specialty. I think there's a challenge in knowing when you can put forth deliberate, careful information that represents the missions and values of the group, but taking a step back and recognizing there are some comments that just need to go unanswered when they're just clearly not worthy of our time or our attention.
Right.
So I think just to add to that, if you're willing to put yourself out there on social media, be prepared to be criticized by anybody and anyone who may be in any kind of mood. And sometimes it's difficult to remain thick-skinned and professional in that scenario when you know that you could fire back a response just as quickly as. So I think you have to be very thoughtful and careful if you're going to put yourself in that group.
And right in line with what Linda was saying about when you're interacting with an investigative reporter, do your homework and find out who that person is and what type of work they're doing. Likewise, if you receive a comment on social media that's inappropriate, sometimes it's worth it just to click on that person and see who they are. If I have someone criticizing my work and it's a well-known investigator in a similar field who's sharing different data, that's going to be more important to me to really understand why we aren't seeing eye to eye. When I get a post from someone who says women shouldn't be cardiothoracic surgeons and I click on his link and he's a medical student in a country that doesn't speak our language and he has 4 followers, it's going to be of less relevance and it's not worth my time. It's not even worth the time that I've already put into thinking, you know, about it. So
let me follow up on that, Robin. My kids introduced me to the term ghosting on social media, which basically means not answering. So going to Mara's point, when do you choose to ghost someone versus engage like that?
Have you ever ghosted?
No. in all honesty, it's an environment that I stay away from for that reason. Just because, you know, you can make a simple, straightforward point and have that turn into a conversation that becomes ludicrous over time. And so unless you know, have some of the tactics and are thoughtful enough about it, like you are, I think it's a totally different game to get into. And in all honesty, I avoid it.
Linda, let me steer back to the interview process and going to some of the points that you made. What do you do with a question that you either can't answer, which might be easier, or more challengingly, what if you don't want to answer it because you know it's going to go in a bad direction?
Well, a few things, and I will confess I learned this from Jean Meserve, who is a CNN reporter, and luckily at University of Virginia they have these leadership classes, and we had a whole session with this seasoned CNN reporter, and she came in and taught us how to do the interviews. And so some of the pointers that she gave us is when you get a question that makes you uncomfortable and it's not live, say, can you repeat the question, just to give you a little more time to think about it. Also, when they throw out some very inflammatory term, make sure you don't repeat that back in your answer because it just gives it more life. So try to steer away from those really inflammatory terms. And if you can't answer it, well, you can't answer it. But I think those are some tactics that you can use. And again, without a live interview, you can stop, take a deep breath, kind of gather yourself and ask to start over again.
So the politicians, I think, and when you do learn these interview techniques, sometimes say you don't have to answer the question. You can state your own comment that may or may not even be related to the question. Is that legitimate?
It's a little bit shifty, but I think it can be done. So, I mean, sometimes you want to think about what message you want to get across during the interview before you even get there and have a few stock phrases. As we all know, there's this 7.4 second sound bite that people use, or, you know, people have short attention spans, so you got to think of how to distill your message into 2 or 3 words and have those key phrases in your mind and be ready to come back with them. So maybe it is a complete shift in a avoidance of the question, but if you get the right message out there, then that counts.
John, Robert, any other tricks for getting the point across?
Again, I really think honesty and forthrightness is the most important thing. When you have questions that there are no good answers to or makes your position look challenging, I think it's fair to say, I don't think I should answer that question, or I would like you to ask me a different question. I think that we can be put in awkward positions, and it's only going to be awkward if we let ourselves remain in those positions. So I have no trouble changing the topic. And if it's a good reporter, they probably have a list of 10 questions. They'll just go on to the next one.
Yeah, I think you want to control the message and not let the reporter control the message that you want to get across. And I think honesty, being factual, and not saying anything that can be held against you or that is incorrect. So I think that's kind of the best strategy to approach that problem.
Has anyone tried anecdotes on interviews? Do those work? Do they get too? They're not certainly not going to be 7 seconds.
But I think anecdotes are a good strategy because it personalizes it, and I think it makes it more digestible to the audience. Like we were talking about, another thing I learned was WIFM, what's in it for me, and try to make sure you think from the audience perspective, what do they want to get out of this? And I think an anecdote is a good way to get across a personalized version of the message.
So just shifting gears a bit as we come to the end of this, I think sometimes these interview opportunities come to us. In other cases, there's an opportunity to cultivate media relations with local newscasters or the like. So maybe we could just go around the table, starting with you, John. How do you do that? Do you have any experience with it? And if so, what have you learned?
I think many reporters, if they're the local science reporter for a newspaper, they don't know everything, and they certainly don't know the depth of our fields the way that we do, and it helps to provide them with some background information. So take it as an opportunity to educate them about what we do in the field we work in. And most good reporters are very grateful for that, and they more likely than not will, unless they have a huge axe to grind, will treat you fairly going forward with the rest of the interview.
And we have a media relations office at our cancer center, and often the local news stations will solicit for different topics. One example is lung cancer screening, where they want more knowledge about it. They wanted us to get the message out to eligible patients that would be eligible for lung cancer screening. And you know, the media is a very important and very powerful communication platform. You can reach millions of people. It's a very underutilized screening tool. And a lot of people who should be screened aren't screened. And that was an opportunity for us to get that message out to our community.
Likewise, we have a media relations team at our institution as well. And I would say developing a strong relationship with those individuals. I've put a fair amount of effort into getting to know those individuals at my institution so that they know that if there is a question in an area of relevance to my practice, they can contact me and I'm reliable if they need a response to a reporter that evening or to, you know, a written questionnaire by the next day, that I'm reliable and I'll help get them the answers. I would say that's the way that I'm usually approached, is through our media relations team with whom I've developed a relationship, and they understand my practice and the types of patients whom I treat. But I have also been contacted by media folks directly who have found me through social media. So I think the more you build your own online presence and put your name out there, the more attention you will get for subsequent opportunities.
I think that's really true. I think that it's important to develop not only relationships, but to do some research before you get interviewed. We think that we have control because we have control over what we say, but what you sometimes don't realize is that you have zero control after that. They're not going to write their piece and show it to you before it goes out. So you really have to be very careful about who you deal with and look for some reliability there.
Any other points?
Similar to the other panelists, I've had contact with our media relations team, but also I think if you have an impactful piece of research or a paper that you've done or a project you've presented that you think is really important to get out there, you can go to them and say, hey, let's publicize this.
Absolutely.
And I've had it publicized on radio, local newspaper, local news stations, things like that, and it can be a good way to get your work known and out there, so you can use them just as much as they can use you.
That's terrific.
Linda, let me follow up on something you said before about the 7-second soundbite. So do you think in quotes? Do you try to titrate your answers to pithy, quotable moments?
It's a work in progress.
There you go. That's.
And I would mention, too, another thing is I learned from this media training is posture is incredibly important. And then what you say and how you say it matters very little, but the way you're positioned and the way you sit and how comfortable you look apparently has more than 50% of an impact on how you're perceived.
Excellent. How are we doing?
I don't know. I'm still working on it myself.
Good. So let me go around the table one more time for either best interactions with media or worst. We'll leave that open-ended.
Let's see. So I guess best, I did an interview on lung cancer screening and I had my messages ready to go and it was pretty innocuous. It went just fine because I was prepared.
I think the best is when the reporter's message is the same as yours. That's the best way to get the kind of information you want out there.
Okay.
I would say one of the best interactions that I had was a live radio interview related to lung cancer screening, where we thought we were just educating the public about the benefits to lung cancer screening, but ultimately ended up receiving a number of patients who sought care in our institution after that interview, and really felt like we were able to bring an additional service to a community that otherwise was somewhat underserved.
So last month I completed my 105th robotic load for the year. Our robotics coordinator actually tweeted it and put it out there in Twitter land, and the president of the university was the first person to like it. So I got immediate recognition.
That works.
Yeah, that works, yeah.
You're being followed.
That was exactly, by the president of the university.
John?
Well, I had an experience once where the reporter's facts were just wrong. And I had to explain to him what the accurate facts were. And I think in retrospect, it would have been better to have spent a few minutes ahead of time asking him, are you going to present any facts? And making sure that we both agree that those facts are the facts, rather than create an uncomfortable situation where you have to correct him, because that can come off condescending or argumentative. And you certainly don't want to do that.
That's great. And I'll actually reinforce that with a story of my own. So we were being investigated by 60 Minutes back up in New York, and they probably were going after us for a particular event, which they misunderstood. Going to your point, actually, to my surprise, we were able to explain, walk them through the situation. The producer, as you know, was doing the background story, and they got it. And they actually shifted their story and ended up being very impactful in a way that we would have done it, and we were able to redirect them. So I think, going to your point, John, if you have a reasonable counterpart, which is not necessarily always the case, I think very often they are trying to do a good job, and that's why they've become reporters, and it can make a difference.
We have to keep in mind that their careers are going to be dependent on being identified as fair and accurate, and if they report on facts that are not accurate, they look bad. So we could help them by making sure that the facts are accurate before the lights come on.
Right. Great. Any closing comments or points that anyone would like to make?
Great discussion.
Great. Well, I want to thank everyone on behalf of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, and hopefully we were able to help our listeners, viewers. Thank you.